From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, British mystery writer P.D. James talks to our book critic, Maureen Carrigan, who teaches a course on detective fiction. James is one of the masters of the form. Her 15th book, A Certain Justice, is currently number 4 on the New York Times bestseller list. They'll talk about suspicious characters, sinister places, and the differences between American and British mystery writers. Also, Ken Tucker reviews a CD by British artist Ronnie Size and his group Represent. They won England's most prestigious pop music award. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The White House says President Clinton is outraged at allegations that he had an affair with a former White House intern. Spokesman Mike McCurry says Mr. Clinton denies any improper relationship with the young woman and is urging everyone to tell the truth in the matter. The unproven report has apparently broadened an investigation by Whitewater Independent Counsel Kenneth Starr. Mr. Clinton's attorney, Robert Bennett, says the president has denied the affair under oath. Bennett says he smells a rat. Pope John Paul is in the midst of a 12-hour flight to Cuba. Observers say it may be the most important trip of his papacy. NPR's Silvia Poggioli reports from Rome.
This is the ailing pontiff's 81st overseas trip in his 20-year papacy, and there are great expectations in Cuba and beyond that it will be a catalyst for political change. Many analysts, however, do not expect the trip to turn into an anti-Marxist crusade, similar to John Paul's first papal trip to his homeland, Poland, in 1979. They say John Paul is likely to use this trip to reiterate his views on the failings of both Marxism and what he considers the unbridled capitalism that has engulfed most of post-communist Eastern Europe. The plane carrying the Pope, his entourage, and the Vatican press corps is expected to arrive in Havana at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. John Paul will be greeted by Fidel Castro in the first of at least two meetings between the two aging ideological adversaries. Silvia Poggioli, NPR News, Rome.
Reputed organized crime boss John Gotti Jr. has been indicted on racketeering charges in New York State. Gotti's father, John Gotti Sr., is already serving a life sentence for murder and racketeering charges. New York's attorney general has filed charges against three state businesses and a New Jersey man, accusing them of price gouging after this month's ice storm in the Northeast. From North Country Public Radio, Mitch Tyke reports.
The charges allege that the companies grossly inflated their prices for gas-powered generators in the days after the storm. In one instance, a Syracuse company is reported to have sold generators off the back of a truck for more than double their normal $550 cost. Joe Mahoney, a spokesman for Attorney General Dennis Vacco, says these cases illustrate exactly why the state's price gouging laws were written.
This law talks about a gross disparity between what an item would normally cost and what the new charge would be in light of the attempt to exploit a situation.
Mahoney says more charges are likely as reports come in about merchants overcharging on everything from kerosene to bread. The businesses charged could face fines of $10,000 for each incident. For NPR News, I'm Mitch Tyke in Canton, New York.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 91 points at 77.81. The Nasdaq is down 3.5 at 1586. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is lower after posting a nearly 120-point gain yesterday. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
Investors remain focused on the flow of quarterly earnings, and today's numbers have been mixed. In the spotlight is IBM, which reported results that were below expectations last night after the market closed. However, its rival, Compaq Computer, recorded stronger-than-expected profit. At the same time, there were stronger-than-expected earnings from Caterpillar, Delta Airlines, and Exxon, but disappointments from Household International and Texas Instruments. I'm Doug Krisner.
The government says the nation's trade gap dropped 11% in November to $8 billion. The Commerce Department says that's the best report in 8 months. The gap was smaller than expected, and analysts say this means it will take more time for the Asian financial crisis to show up in the figures. Many economists predict Asia will export more goods to the United States because they cannot sell them at home. This will cause the U.S. trade deficit to swell, they warn. Drug makers SmithKline-Beecham and American Home Products say they're thinking about a merger, but both say there are no guarantees that their talks will work out. And antitrust experts say any potential marriage between the firms would be closely watched by regulators. A published report says defense company Raytheon will cut up to 10,000 jobs at its defense and aerospace plants around the country. The Los Angeles Times reports the plan would reduce Raytheon costs by at least 10% in its systems unit, which includes the former aerospace operations of Hughes Aircraft and Texas Instruments. Raytheon employs 87,000 people in the country. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music in more than 200 neighborhoods across the United States, where browsing is a fine art. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Few people we can think of are as enthusiastic and informed about detective fiction as our book critic Maureen Corrigan. She even teaches a course on the subject. So when we heard that the British writer P.D. James, one of the most popular and respected living mystery writers, was visiting here, we decided to bring her together with Maureen for a conversation, which we're about to hear. P.D. James began writing mysteries in the early 1960s when she was holding down a full-time job in the British Civil Service and raising two daughters on her own after the untimely death of her young husband. The enormous popularity of her novels and of her detective hero, Adam Dogleish, eventually allowed her to devote herself full-time to writing. In 1991, Queen Elizabeth made P.D. James a baroness in recognition of her literary achievements. Reviewers routinely place James in the same company as mystery masters like Agatha Christie, Arthur Conan Doyle, and Dorothy Sayers. James' new novel, A Certain Justice, is a characteristically brooding tale that opens on a murder trial. A young man named Gary Ash is accused of having brutally murdered his aunt. Ash is successfully defended by the brilliant criminal lawyer Venetia Aldridge. Then shortly after the trial ends, Venetia's bloody body is discovered in chambers, her office in the criminal court. With P.D. James, however, there's always much more going on underneath the murder and mayhem, as Maureen learned when they spoke.
P.D. James, it's really an honor for me to talk with you. I'm a great fan of yours, and I do think that with every novel, your writing gets richer and more contemplative and even more philosophical, and yet you manage to wed those philosophical musings to an often terrifying thriller plot. It's certainly the case in a Certain Justice that you managed to create a thriller plot and yet also give us this deeper contemplation of the meaning of evil and meaning of life. I think we could loosely categorize A Certain Justice as a legal thriller, and that's a new area for you.
Yes.
Why did you decide to enter into the legal world
novel? Yes, you're absolutely right. A legal thriller is a good description of it. But I think what most attracted me was the contrast between the order, the dignity, the history, traditions, hierarchy, and indeed the very great pomp and courtesy with which a criminal trial is conducted in England and the appalling events with which it's concerned. The idea of this crime, the worst crime, the most contaminating crime, coming into that ordered world and, as it were, shattering it. And I'm interested anyway in the criminal law. I always have been. So I think those ideas came together.
I'd like to ask you to read the passage in which a clerk who's working in the Inns of Court discovers Venetia's body.
Yes, I think the moment in the book when the body is discovered is one of huge importance for the reader. Mm-hmm. And I always describe it through the eyes of the character who makes the discovery. And it seems to me that the horror that character feels must be conveyed to the reader. Murder is an appalling crime, to find a murdered body. So this is what I try to do. And here, as you know, the body is discovered by Harry Norton, who is the clerk to Chambers, the administrator of Chambers, really. Mm. Elderly man, just about to retire, coming to work to open the office, rather burdened with his own problems about retirement and his family, and meets this appalling sight. This is the actual moment when he unlocks Venetia's room and finds her dead. He moved slowly forward, as if drawn by the inexorable pull of a thread. She was sitting well back in the swivel chair behind her desk. The desk was to the left of the door, facing the two tall windows. Her head was slumped forward on her chest. Her arms hung loosely over the curved arms of the chair. He couldn't see her face, but he knew that she was dead. On her head was a full-bottomed wig, its stiff curls of horsehair, a mass of red and brown blood. Moving towards her, he put the back of his right hand against her cheek. It was ice cold. Surely even dead flesh couldn't be as cold as this. The touch, gentle as it had been, dislodged a globule of blood from the wig. He watched horrified as it rolled in slow spurts over the dead cheek to tremble on the edge of her chin. He moaned in terror. He thought, "Oh God, she's cold, she's dead cold, but the blood is still tacky." Instinctively, he clutched at the chair for support, and to his horror it swung slowly round until she was facing the door, her feet dragging on the carpet. He gasped and drew back, looking appalled at his hand, as if expecting it to be sticky with blood. Then he leaned forward and, stooping, tried to look into her face. The forehead, the cheeks and one eye were covered with the congealed blood. Only the right eye was unsullied. The dead, unseeing stare, fixed on some far enormity, seemed, as he gazed at it, to hold a terrible malice.
Thank you, P.D. James. I think I can breathe again now. It's really wonderful. That passage in all of its gory glory is so typical of you and in your writing. I'm wondering how you sleep at night with these visions swimming in your head.
Well, I never manage ever to frighten myself. Other writers can frighten me, but I never manage really to frighten myself. I suppose really that is because as a writer, I'm part of the book. I'm when I'm writing that, I am with Harry. I am actually experiencing exactly what Harry is experiencing. But with part of my mind, I'm selecting the right words, you know, wondering whether he will touch her, where he will touch her, what the effect of touching her will be, and so forth, so that one is both part of it and detached.
Mm-hmm. Back to poor Venetia for a moment. You say that in the case that Venetia's trying before she's murdered, that which is also a very sinister case, a man is accused of murdering his aunt and of almost certainly having sexual relations with her before he kills her.
Yes.
You write that Venetia had one great advantage in this case, and that was that there was no instinctive sympathy for the victim. I don't think that there's any instinctive sympathy for Venetia herself as a victim either. And I think that's a risk that you take as a writer, that, that we readers, to paraphrase Edmund Wilson, might ask you, who cares who murdered Venetia Aldridge, the way Edmund Wilson once wrote, who cares who murdered Roger Ackroyd, about Agatha Christie's famous novel?
Yes, I think there's a difference. I think he was criticizing the whole genre, wasn't he?
Yes,
he just
was.
Saying that with all puzzles, which they were ingenious puzzles, he didn't care. Who did care? Mm-hmm. And possibly the reason why he didn't care was that none of the people ever came alive for him. I think with the modern detective story, what is important is to make these people come alive. There may not be much sympathy for Venetia, although I have considerable sympathy for her, because although I think she is an extremely difficult woman, in many ways a disagreeable one, and a woman who makes enemies, I show what her background is, what her past has been, and this could have been a woman who had a very unsuccessful and bitter life. And although there is some bitterness there, she has made a successful career. She's ambitious. She's also beautiful. That's hardly to her credit. She's extremely able. She's a useful member of society. And I think, therefore, that when she's done to death, there is a sadness about that, even if she's not particularly likable.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me, though, that oftentimes your victims fit this mold of being ambitious, careerists, sometimes even snobbish. And if they're not the victims, they're the murderers. That it's almost as though you you deal with these people in your books by putting them in the negative roles. And I wonder how you deal with people like that when you meet them in life.
You mean very successful
people? Yes, yeah.
I think I deal with them exactly as I find them. Many of them, of course, because I'm a member of the House of Lords, are my personal friends.
Yes.
I'm not over-impressed by great success or great ambition, and certainly I'm not over-impressed by great wealth. Mm. So that if they are pleasant, good, entertaining, compassionate, clever people, I'm very fond of them. And if they're not, I'm not. And, you know, the amount of success they've got is totally, to me, irrelevant. I think in a detective story, it's almost inevitable that the victim, and to an extent probably the murderer, will have some of these qualities, really. You're very unlikely to have a murderer, you know, who is a very humble, hard-working, good, pleasant, compassionate father of four children and goes regularly to the office and does his rather humble job well. The salt of the earth, in other words. A truly good person. A truly good person isn't going to be tempted to murder. So inevitably you're in a world in which all these strong emotions really are thrashing around. Mm. You do have victims who are unpleasant and difficult and unlikable and make enemies. And both among the suspects and, of course, with the murderer himself or herself, someone who is capable of that deed. And it often does go with hubris, I think. It very seldom goes with humility.
We're listening to mystery writer P.D. James in conversation with Fresh Air book critic Maureen Carrigan. James has a new novel called A Certain Justice. We'll get back to their talk after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to a conversation between British mystery writer P.D. James and our book critic, Maureen Carrigan.
Another character who appears in this novel is one with whom we're familiar, those of us who know and love your books, and that's Commander Adam Dalgleish. Mm-hmm. It seems, though, that Dalgleish plays a minor role in this novel, or a smaller role than he has in many of your other novels. And I'm wondering if, perhaps like Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, you're growing a little weary of Adam Dalgleish and might try to get rid of him as your series goes on.
No, that isn't so at all. No. He may seem to play a smaller part, but I think that is because of the way in which I've constructed the novel. He can't appear, really, until the murder is committed. That's when he's called in, because a murder has been committed. And therefore, for about a third of the book, when I'm describing the victim, I'm describing Venetia and her past and what's made of the kind of woman she is, the life of Chambers, the people who live in Chambers, and, of course, the appalling result for her of the acquittal of the psychopath Gary Ash. It's not relevant to have Dalgleish there. So inevitably, he's not there for part of the book. Once the murder takes place, he is certainly very much in control. There's only about one scene in the investigation where he isn't actually physically present from start to finish. So the impression may be that he's not there, but I think if he's there anymore, the whole structure of the book would be thrown totally out. I mean, it's nice perhaps for readers to have two or three chapters about what he's doing in his home life, but that's not the way to construct a mystery. If you really want to have each of your suspects a living, credible, interesting human being, there's space only for so much, and I think it would have thrown it out of kilter. I'm also, I think, very interested in his team, in the relationship of Kate with him, yes. In the relationship of Kate with the new member of the team, Piers Tarrant. And all that would be lost if I had far more of Dalgleish.
Yeah, these are two of Dalgleish's detectives.
That's yes. It. They're mm-hmm. members of his team, yes. essentially. Yes. yes.
Yeah. Dalgleish, I mean, he's a fascinating character, and I know many women, including myself, who probably are a little attracted to him romantically. Yeah. He's a poet. He's a loner. He's that irresistible breed of man who looks like he needs a little cheering up.
Yes, he does, doesn't he? I think that's true. We all feel we can give him
we
that.
We can do it, yes. 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 And, I know you've admitted in other interviews that he's perhaps a bit of an alter ego for you. He likes to tour churches and walk by
yes.
the sea, which
he's
are activities.
He's got a lot of the things I like. Yes, in of me in him. It's sort of, that's perfectly true. I suppose he's a rather, oh dear, what shall I say? He has the qualities which I very much admire, either in men or women, and he has many of my own likes and dislikes. He lives his life very much as I would live it, you know, if I were Dalgleish, I think.
Do you feel at all that you may have fallen into the trap that Dorothy Sayers fell into, where she created a detective hero who she herself felt attracted to?
I don't think so. I don't think I'm in love with my hero. I think she was certainly in love with Peter Williams, yes. and indeed changed him in order to make of him a love object more suitable for her affections, which is always a risk, I think, with a detective, that he changes from the fundamental character which you begin with. I admire Dalgleish and respect him, and I'm extremely fond of him. I don't think I'm in love with him. No, I don't feel that about him.
Oh, I was hoping to trap you into a confession here.
I am very fond of him. Yes. I'm not sure I'd like to work for him, though. I think he would be a very demanding boss.
Yes. How do you feel he has evolved, if not changed, from his first outing?
Well, it's difficult in a way to say, because nothing very drastic has changed in his life. I think more in the time I did get him married, I have to say that. I think really it's getting a little impatient with this solitary life he's got. Just the problem of getting him suitably married off and to whom, that is one I'm rather reluctant to tackle. So nothing greatly has changed, has it? You know, it's not that he's married or had children or anything. Life has gone on for him. I think I understand him more and more as the years go by. I think he's matured. He's been promoted. I think he realises increasingly how much harm a murder investigation can do to the innocent. He's more compassionate, and I think he's more aware of the imperfections of the law. He's more aware that the job he does is a very necessary job, and he's never wanted to do any other job, and he's not ashamed of it. But he can see that it is a job that causes immense distress to other people.
And perhaps even more aware of his own the limitations of his own power. Certainly in this novel,
he can't
set the world right.
Yes, he is. He's not. I mean, in a sense, I suppose you can regard the classical detective story as a kind of modern morality play in which the detective does represent goodness, justice, decency, intellectual power, the force of good against the forces of evil. And it seemed very much like it, I think, in many of the books in the 1930s. And even, of course, you know, with the Chandler hero, you know, the white knight striding down these streets who's not himself afraid and so on. Somewhat romanticised, as indeed the British detectives were romanticised. But I think Dalgleish realises that, you know, it is not like that. Yes. And this is, in some ways, I was going to say, almost a grubby job.
When people talk about your novels, inevitably they mention your sense of place, the sense of place in your novels. And Original Sin, for instance, people will talk about that strange 18th century Venetian palace, which houses a publishing house on the Thames. And other times you've created Victorian mansions or dilapidated churches where murders have taken place. I think this novel has an overabundance of sinister places that you really bring to life here. Would you describe for our listeners some of the key places in this novel?
Yes, I think what you've said is right, and place is tremendously important to me. I think one of the most horrible and sinister places is the house where the murder of the aunt takes place. When the book opens, of course, we have Venetia defending young Gary Ash, who is accused of the brutal murder, the slashing to death of his aunt. His aunt obviously is a prostitute. And they live in this house on a road which is being widened. So all the properties, of course, are being compulsorily purchased for the road widening and boarded up and knocked down. So there's this terrible desolation. And then, of course, you have places which aren't really in themselves sinister, like the Temple Church and Chambers. But
it seems as though a certain light makes them sinister, doesn't it?
Indeed it can. I think place is so important in a crime novel. It, of course, does create atmosphere, but it can enhance, I think, menace by contrast between beauty and order and hierarchy, decency, and this extraordinarily disruptive crime. And, of course, it does interpret character and also adds credibility, because the more the place is real to the reader, the more the somewhat bizarre the bizarre events of the plot are rooted in the firm soil of reality.
Mm-hmm. Are you sensitive to the power of place in your everyday life?
Very, yes.
Places that you've walked into and, I don't know, maybe felt an atmosphere that something violent had happened here? Or
I do feel sad. That. I've been trying to tell myself that, in fact, I don't feel it any more than other people feel it. I wouldn't claim that I feel it particularly, but I undoubtedly do feel it. And I've certainly had examples. I had one fairly recently when I was in Brighton, a seaside town, visiting a friend and his sister, and he's a priest, and we were sitting in his study, and I felt, thank God, that this room isn't his guest room or his sister's guest room, because if she'd put me in here, I couldn't have slept the night. This is terrible. And then later I read a book by Francis King, who's one of our writers, who sold that house to the priest. And it's his autobiography, and he described selling this house, which he was very fond of, to the priest. And he said, but there was one room in which he couldn't enter because the atmosphere was so strong. But he wrote in his book, but however, it's now the priest's study, so perhaps he manages to do something about it. But I felt it very strongly.
It's fascinating. It makes you almost want to do some research to find out what happened.
It didn't make
room.
Me, yes. Yeah. You're so right, Marie. I always take that reaction myself. Yeah. When something like this happens, I want to do research. I want to find what happened in that room.
Yes.
P.D. James talking with Fresh Air book critic Maureen Corrigan. The conversation continues in the second half of the show. James' new novel is called A Certain Justice. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Fresh Air's book critic Maureen Corrigan continues her conversation with British mystery novelist P.D. James. And Ken Tucker reviews the latest CD from British drum and bass group Ronnie Size and Represent.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to continue our conversation between British mystery writer P.D. James and our book critic Maureen Corrigan. James has a new novel called A Certain Justice. When we left off, they were talking about the sinister settings James uses in her novels and the importance of creating places that seem real.
Another place that you describe so powerfully in this and other novels, other more recent novels, is a public housing project where the public housing project where Kate Miskin, yes, one of Dalgliesh's detectives, yes, was born and grew up. And
yes,
I really love her character. Yes. She's very gutsy. She's also very, yes, independent and solitary and kind of pulled herself up by her own bootstraps to get out of that housing project.
She has.
Yeah.
She goes back, doesn't she? And
she
sees
goes,
it.
Right.
Yes, and visits it again.
She goes back, and what I felt from that scene, though, was that she didn't belong in the world of the public housing project anymore, but she also didn't completely belong to the middle-class world of the police, which she had entered by her own effort. Mm-hmm. And I'm intrigued by this portrait of class tension that you develop with her character. And this may be a stretch, so you'll tell me, but I know that you yourself came from middle-class origins. Now,
yes,
now you are Baroness James of Holland Park. And
yes,
I wonder if you feel any tension within yourself about kind of belonging to two worlds in terms of class.
No, I can honestly say I never have. And it was interesting to me when I worked as a bureaucrat in the Home Department, that it seemed to me that some of the men who had not, in fact, been to Oxford or Cambridge, been to other universities, felt at some disadvantage because they weren't at one of the two major universities, just as people here might feel at disadvantage if they weren't on Ivy League. I wasn't at any university, but whether it was because I was a woman or because I was a writer, it didn't in the least bit worry me. It never has. And I never am worried, actually, by class. I think I just judge people whether I think they're good people, interesting, clever people, or whether I don't like them, and class never actually comes into it. But class is very interesting to a novelist, and I think you are so right about Kate, because until now, Kate has never bothered herself about class. It's never worried her. That's not the kind of woman she is. But in this book, really, for the first time, and in the relationship with the new young man, you suddenly feel it's really not so much, it is class in a way, but a sense somehow that because they've had the education, she hasn't.
Yes.
And do you remember that she remembers that Dalgliesh had said, would she not like to take, time
off? And she bristles at that.
To take a degree. And she obviously responds really very ungraciously. And I think she is beginning to feel that the two men somehow have something, a kind of understanding, a kind of comradeship, a taking of life more lightly.
Yes.
That she can't, in fact, sort of do herself.
Do you think that maybe part of the reason also why you don't have whatever self-consciousness about class, walking into the House of Lords, for
yes,
instance, for the first time,
yes,
is because you are a writer and somehow artists belong to this other class unto themselves?
Oh, I'm sure you're right, Maureen. I'm absolutely sure you're right. Absolutely. Mm. Yes, I'm sure that's right.
Mm.
And you get a kind of respect because you belong to that world.
Yes.
You don't have to compete in the other world. You have your world, and if you're preeminent in that,
do you get
that's
that respect from everyone, or do some people look at you and say, well, she's only a mystery writer? Because certainly we've heard mysteries in the academy, mysteries are sort of looked down upon as second-class literature.
Well, I think there is a difference between our two countries here. I'm beginning to feel this. I mean, you have mystery writers who are fine novelists by any criteria, but the names that come to mind tend to be the older ones, really, Hammett and Chandler, who have had, as you know better because you're an academic and you teach them, have had an effect, really, on literature and on fiction, far beyond any effect even that they've had on mysteries and on crime writing. But undoubtedly, when I go into shops here, an extraordinary amount of of writing here that goes on in the mystery format, far more than at home. And it's difficult to believe that a lot of these novels really have great merit. I think if they had, they'd probably been published back home and I would have heard of them.
Right.
I think back home we have people, Ruth Rendell is an example, John le Carré is another, of course, who are very fine novelists. And therefore, there isn't quite that attitude back home. The detective novel, the crime novel, is, on the whole, respected.
We were talking a moment ago about Kate Miskin, who has become one of my favorite characters of yours. Mm-hmm. And I think another reason why I like her, in addition to her sense of independence, is because she reminds me of Cordelia Gray, who was your first female detective. Oftentimes in essays that I read on mystery fiction, other writers are credited with creating the first female private eye. We seem to focus a lot on American female private eyes.
Yes.
And I think you're overlooked unfairly. You were really the first, weren't you, to create, at least in Britain, a female private eye who worked professionally as a detective.
I think I probably was, because it was a very early book of mine, wasn't it? And I can't remember the year.
1972.
Oh, well, yes. I think it probably was. That's quite true. I'm often asked when I'm going to return to Cordelia. Of course, I think it depends on finding the right plot. But I also suspect that I've got so interested in Kate. I love writing about a woman detective. And if I hadn't a woman detective on Dalgliesh's team, then I would have returned to Cordelia out of the need, really, the sort of emotional need and the artistic need and the just literary need to be writing about a woman detective. Mm. But as I'm glad you like Kate, because I like Kate and I love writing about Kate. So I think she's rather taken attention, my writing attention, away from Cordelia.
Of course, Cordelia could always return and marry Adam Dalgliesh. There seemed to be a little spark between them.
There was certainly a little spark there between them, and something undoubtedly is going on between them. They never tell me anything about it. I don't know. It's very tricky marrying off your detective,
yes.
You know.
It's usually fatal.
But it's certainly time he got himself his wife. It usually is fatal. Mm. I think you're quite right.
I've recently reread An Unsuitable Job for a Woman, and I think that scene in which Cordelia is down in a well trying to get herself out is one of the most brilliant and suspenseful scenes in mystery fiction. It's amazing.
I'm claustrophobic, and nothing would be more horrible for me than to be thrown down a well. It really would be very, very dreadful. Mm. So I'm quite surprised I managed to write that, to experience her horror there, because that is something that really would be dreadful for me.
Do you read mystery fiction that features female detectives? And if so, what do you think of it?
I haven't read a great deal of it, really. I've read the American ones. Their names escape me.
Sarah Paretsky, Sue Grafton.
Right. And the one who's in Santa Monica.
Sue Grafton's
Grafton.
Detective.
Yes, yeah. I've actually read most of Sue Grafton's and most of Paretsky's too. Those are the chief ones, and I've read Liza Cody back home. I like Grafton because her detective does seem, you know, to concern herself with keeping records and what she's going to wear and getting her exercise and finding she hasn't eaten and she's hungry and where will she eat and sending in her bills. In fact, you do feel that she is a professional private eye. This is all part of her life. It isn't over-romanticized, and I like that. I feel there's a personal experience there, or a personal experience that she's able to convey. And I found after I'd been to California, of course, that it meant much more. As soon as you know the location, it means more.
But that's the difficulty, isn't it, in writing books that deal with crime and the investigation of crime. You have to make them realistic. So you have to show the detective working at these mundane tasks,
exactly,
like taking notes.
Exactly.
But you also need to sustain the reader's interest. So
quite. You're so right. And I mean, this is where I suppose it's difficult to write a book that you could really call realistic, because so much realistic investigation of murder is just dull plodding, you know, going from street to street, and teamwork rather than one person. Whereas, of course, the tradition of detective story is that you have this amazing detective who sort of symbolizes a kind of triumphant individualism, really, rather than just a member of a team.
Yes.
I also feel, really, with some of them, that the first person singular, although it gives immediacy to a narrative, and certainly credibility, because you're more likely to believe someone who's telling you face to face, this is what I did, it may have seemed silly at the time, but that's why I did it, is limiting in that you are only in one mind, you're seeing only through one pair of eyes the whole time, aren't you?
Yeah, and that's the tradition that we have in America, the Raymond Chandler,
so,
Philip Marlowe, first
yes,
person.
Absolutely, the first person. Yeah. Whereas I like to go into different minds and sort of assume different viewpoints throughout the novel. I think it adds complexity. And anyway, it's the way I really prefer to work.
And certainly suspense as well, yeah.
Yes, I think so. Yeah.
We're listening to mystery writer P.D. James in conversation with Fresh Air book critic Maureen Corrigan. James has a new novel called A Certain Justice. We'll get back to their talk after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our conversation between British mystery writer P.D. James and our book critic, Maureen Corrigan.
Another aspect of your novels, in addition to the intricate plotting and characters and the sense of place, I think that oftentimes it seems you're exploring the role of faith in a fallen world. And I'm always taking note of how often you have characters related to religious institutions in some way. Adam Dalgliesh's father was a minister, and Cordelia Gray went to a convent school. Murders take place in or near churches sometimes. Sometimes when I'm reading you, you remind me of G.K. Chesterton in the sense of almost being a religious mystery writer, and it seems like you were exploring this deeper mystery of the role of evil in the world.
Yes, I think that I'm very interested in religious experience. I'm interested in people's attitudes to religion. And I think I have a religious view of life myself. I don't mean I'm a good Christian, I'm far from that, but I have a religious view of life, really, and an awareness somehow of that other dimension. And therefore, I like to introduce characters into the books who share that. But they're not usually my main characters. And I'm interested in the effect of religious belief on people. And in this book particularly, because Pierce Tarrant, who's a new member of the team, is from Oxford and got a degree in theology, and this interests, of course, Kate very much, because Kate is, I was going to say, a religious. I mean, she does not, she has no belief, religious beliefs. And Dalgliesh is, I would say, a sympathetic agnostic. And she says, doesn't she, to Piers Tarrant, well, you know, what do you believe? You've got a degree in theology, what do you believe? Now, how do you really, what rule do you apply to run your life? And Piers says, to get as much pleasure as I can, not to hurt other people, and not to whine. And Kate thinks, yes, well, nothing wrong with that. And that's more or less how she lives her life, to get as much pleasure as possible, but not to hurt others and not to whine. And then she realises, yes, but it isn't the answer to the sort of thing she'd been dealing with. It isn't the answer to a raped and murdered child. It isn't the answer to what we think of as evil. It isn't the answer to great sins or great unhappiness. And I think that it's that awareness that it isn't somehow enough, that somehow there's something else needed.
Do you feel as though you're using the mystery form to explore the possibility of faith and the efficacy of faith in a fallen world?
Well, not, I think, in the sense of deliberately feeling I'm doing that. I don't think I'm really a didactic writer. I think this is what tends to happen, that I set out to tell a story, the story that's come to me gradually, and somehow these extraneous matters get introduced as I write. I remember I was giving an essay in Ely Cathedral, not an essay, a speech talk, I suppose, a lecture in Ely Cathedral. They have a series of lectures from people prominent in various aspects of English life. And I was asked to lecture on the moral responsibility of the novelist. And at question time, one of them said, well, why haven't you made Dalgliesh a Christian? Mm. And as a writer, I could only say, well, because he isn't. He isn't one.
He won't become one. He won't cooperate.
No, because to an extent, you know, that is the character I've committed. He has a great reverence for religion. And it's interesting in the book when they are meeting the priest and of course, he's heard a confession and he won't break the seal. And we have Kate just impatient that he can't at least give them a hint as to whether they should still be looking for a murderer or whether he knows. Dalgliesh doesn't argue or say anything at all because Dalgliesh absolutely understands.
Yes, yeah, and respects even and if respects. He
that is
isn't
what
wholeheartedly a part
he
of the institution.
He understands and respects. Yeah. So he doesn't even argue with the priest.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to go on here into another topic for a moment. All the biographical essays that I've read about you always say that you began your writing career late at age 39, which no longer seems to be that late to me. But and now that you're several decades older, I wonder how your writing routine has changed, if it has, and your interests have changed.
I don't think the writing routine has changed very much because I always got up early in the morning to write, and for most of my writing life I was doing a full-time job because I had a sick husband and children to support and needed something rather safer than the writing. So I didn't retire from a full-time job as a bureaucrat until I was 59 and a half. So it was weekends, holidays, and very early in the morning, and it's still early in the morning. Mm. I'm freshest in the morning. I get tired as the day goes on. The early afternoon is the worst time for me. I can often revive in the late evening, but the late afternoon afternoon is very bad. But the mornings are good. So when I'm actually writing, which I'm not doing at the moment, I will still get up early and try and get 2 or 3 hours in, you know, before the telephone goes and the working world wakes up.
On a good day, how much are you able to write? How many pages?
Well, I don't think of it much by the day, but I do try, because I think it's helpful to try and set some kind of target, and it's usually about between eight or 10,000 words a week, and that would be going quite hard, really. Mm-hmm. When I say a week, that would be a seven day week, not a 5 day week. Mm-hmm. I think 1,000 original words, as it were, 1,500 at most, is quite a day's work, really.
Have you ever hit a dry
if I
spell?
If kept that up, it'd be 365,000 words a year, wouldn't it?
Perfect.
Sorry, I interrupted you. Mike.
No, I was wondering, as you were talking, if you had ever hit a dry spell where you simply couldn't write.
No. Partly, I suppose, because there's quite a gap between the books. I don't, as soon as I finish a book, think, right, what should I do now? Mm. I must get started. I'm not a very professional writer, I suppose. I wait until I have an idea which really excites me. I open my whole mind and imagination to the possibility of that idea coming, and it usually until now has come, but I don't settle down at once. So maybe it's because, you know, I do it that way, that I don't seem to have writer's blocks.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of poor Dashiell Hammett sitting staring at his typewriter for decades.
Dreadful.
Trying
That's
to
That's absolute
write.
Hell.
Yeah.
I couldn't do that. I think if I was in the situation that no idea came, I'd feel right. got the 14 books. I've done the very best I can with my talent. I hope I've given a lot of pleasure to a lot of people, and this is it. I'll go to the House of Lords more often, make myself a nuisance there.
One thing I noticed about this latest novel, A Certain Justice, is that you have a couple of characters who are older, who are one of the barristers you mentioned before, who's contemplating retirement, the clerk, who's also very fearful that he might be forced to retire. And I wonder what your own thoughts are about aging.
Well, sometimes we say back home, old age is not for wimps. The alternative, it seems to me, is worse. So I'm very glad that I am of war generation, and many people I know were killed in the war, killed in bombing, and I survived it all. So I'm extremely grateful I have. But there is, I think, the draining away, really, of physical energy, which is sad. The touches of arthritis, the legs which become so sort of heavy, and the joints which become stiff. But the great thing, I think, is to still enjoy each day and to wake up each morning as I do, realizing that it is a privilege to have woken up, that life is a privilege and is here to be enjoyed. And I am, of course, infinitely blessed in so many ways. So I'm not just going to get too morbid about it, I hope.
Well, P.D. James, I'd like to thank you so much for being my guest on Fresh Air.
Well, thank you very much for talking to me. I've enjoyed it immensely, Maureen.
Thank you.
P.D. James spoke with Fresh Air book critic Maureen Corrigan. James' new novel is called A Certain Justice. Coming up, a review of the band that won England's most prestigious pop music award. This is Fresh Air. The most prestigious pop music award in England is the Mercury Music Prize, given by a committee of critics and industry figures. The 1997 Mercury Prize went to Ronnie Sy's and Represent for their double CD New Forms. Ronnie Sy's works in the relatively new genre called drum and bass, an outgrowth of British and American dance music. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
You think that you can hold on when the beat gets too strong, and you feel that you need help to move along? Do you think that you can hang tough when the rhythm gets rough and the DJ says I think you've had enough? Do you think that you can digest when I start to digress, when they get yourself a lyric proof vest? Do you think that you can compete when you hit the fat beat? You need stamina like an athlete, unique. Continue the future technique to full heat. Let the microphone burn when I speak. All right, now we're getting into this sound. Pick it up, shake it up, turn it upside down.
Ronnie Sy's comes from Bristol, the small West England town that has produced an unusually large number of British dance music acts in recent years, ranging from Portishead to Tricky to Massive Attack. Sy's presides over a loose coalition of DJs, rappers, singers, and musicians who call themselves Represent. Together, they build layers of percussion, electronic samples, live instrumentation, and vocals to create long, dreamy, but intense compositions. This music, called drum and bass by its fans and practitioners, began its life in the early 90s in England under the label Jungle Music. It was music played in clubs, meant to be danced to, not pondered in your living room armchair. It was cult music, the great majority of it entirely instrumental, not intended for rock critical analysis or pop radio programming. The trick to expanding both the audience and the ambition of such music is to make it more accessible without sounding as if you're eager to sell out. Common consensus seems to have it that this is what Ronnie Size has done.
I don't know no heroes. They can tell the story. I don't know no heroes. They can get the glory. Yeah. When you dance with this happy, it's alright. And then they kiss you and they tell you that they know you're satisfied. And then say, I don't know no hero.
There's been an awful lot of talk over the past year about electronica, a genre that was supposed to break as big here in America as it has in England and throughout much of Europe. But that hasn't happened, despite a number of extremely alluring releases. My own recommendation in this area would include the Chemical Brothers' Dig Your Own Hole and Spring Heel Jack's Busy, Curious, Thirsty. Ronnie Size, instead of narrowing his scope to remain pure and faithful, has more ambitiously decided to accommodate everything from rap vocals to live string sections. Sometimes he even employs a kind of jazzy scat singing. Much of drum and bass is oral wallpaper, pretty, repetitive, and predictable. But I like the way Ronnie Size makes his beats so hot and intense that the wallpaper often peels. To call this double CD, as more than one writer has, the Sgt. Pepper of its genre may be going too far. But the farther out Ronnie Size himself goes, the better his music sounds.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Amy Salad, and Alan Tu, with Monique Nazareth. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, on the 25th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, we examine changes in medical technology from fetal surgery to the abortion pill and ask how they change the nature of the abortion debate. We'll talk with medical ethicist Art Kaplan. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.